Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steers Show. I'm Lila.
And Leo. And, excuse me. Tonight we have an interview coming up about 8:30 with Dalia Wasfi, and she's the human rights
activist,
and she'll be talking about Rachel Corrie.
It was the anniversary of her death.
7th anniversary of her death,
and if folks remember, she was a young American girl who wanted to make a difference in the world, and she joined a group of pacifists who went to Palestine to try to have an impact on the injustices there. And she was standing in front of a bulldozer. The bulldozer was going to knock over a house of some people where she had spent the night before in Palestine. I think he was a dentist or some kind of professional person, and his wife and their kids, and they Israelis were going to destroy their home. And she had deterred it from happening once by standing in front of a bulldozer. They came back. It was an American bulldozer made in America by Americans, and an Israeli military person was driving it. He drove over her and killed her, broke her back, and then backed up and finished her off.
And I don't know if he was ever prosecuted.
Yeah. They were no criminal. He was acquitted of the investigation, acquitted him of all criminal intent.
Yeah, right.
But her parents are now in Israel. They've conducted a civil suit in court, and that should be the finding on that should be coming soon, I guess, according to Dalia. But you'll be able to hear more in her interview. She gave us an excellent interview. She's you could tell she's a very nice person. She has a Muslim father and a Jewish mother. She was, however, born in this country and spent time in Iraq.
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to go to that interview in a little while. But for the time being, we've got a bunch of articles here that I'd like to...
Here's an interesting one from Natural News. Weight Watchers says edict McDonald's to lose weight. Weight Watchers has now officially endorsed Chicken McNuggets as a healthy meal in New Zealand, where McDonald's restaurants will begin carrying the Weight Watchers logo on several menu items. This bizarre and inexplicable decision has now made Weight Watchers the laughingstock of the health world, where nutrition and weight loss experts normally don't use McDonald's fast food and weight loss in the same sentence. As The Guardian reports, that's an English paper, as part of the deal, which the company says is the first of its kind in the world, McDonald's will use Weight Watchers logo on its menu boards, and Weight Watchers will promote McDonald's to dieters. Nutritionists, not surprisingly, were shocked at the announcement. The idea of eating at McDonald's to lose weight seems a bit ridiculous, and anyone who believes that eating Chicken McNuggets will cause you to lose weight is arguably one nugget short of a Happy Meal. Sometimes you just have to point out the stupidity of these things, even at the risk of offending someone who has convinced themselves that eating more chicken nuggets is a ticket to a slim, fit, and sexy body. Weight Watchers, by the way, never actually claims that eating the foods they will endorse will cause you to lose weight. If you examine it carefully, even their name really isn't about weight loss. It's about weight watching, as in watch your weight grow larger by the day. A weight watch is something like a tornado watch or a tsunami watch. You keep your eyes peeled and wait for something disastrous to happen, such as ballooning to 300 pounds while engaging in unhealthy eating McHabits based on snarfing down meat parts from factory-farmed cows in bovine concentration camps that might more accurately be called cowschwitz. If Weight Watchers is going to endorse McNuggets, then why not just endorse the entire McDonald's menu and throw the logo behind Big Macs, ice cream shakes, too? It's not like Weight Watchers is trying to protect its reputation, but not crossing a line, you know. Once you've endorsed McDonald's as a healthy food, that line is no longer anywhere in sight. Of course, McDonald's products mainly join a long list of questionable foods marketed under the Weight Watchers brand name, a brand that, in my opinion, has discovered great commercial success in selling the false hope of weight loss to clueless consumers who are unwilling to read ingredients listed on food labels. Not coincidentally, Weight Watchers has now become the McDonald's of the weight loss industry, an industry filled with so many scams and shams that the idea of eating chicken nuggets to lose weight doesn't even seem strange to many people. We live in a world where corporate promotional lies are disgusting at best and criminal at worst. We're told that psychiatric drugs will make you happy, that chemotherapy will make you healthy, and that eating at McDonald's will make you lose weight. We're told that sugary junk drinks will give you energy, that toxic vaccines are necessary for your immune system to work correctly, and that buying silly pink ribbon products will somehow cure cancer. At the same time, we're told that vitamins are dangerous, that sunlight causes cancer, and there's no such thing as a cure for type 2 diabetes. Everything that's good for you is discredited as bad, while everything that is toxic is hyped up as healthy. I suppose in the light of the corporate-sponsored sick care insanity that passes for medical advice these days, the idea that eating at McDonald's will make you lose weight doesn't seem as insane as it really should, but that doesn't make it any more true. In a world gone mad with dietary misinformation, touting fictional foods, insanity can now be marketed to the intoxicated mainstream as if it somehow made sense, and people swallow it. And this article is from naturalnews.com, and it was by Mike Adams, the health ranger, the Natural News editor. Very good article, and a little humor thrown in it too, folks. So I'm waiting for Leo to pick an article to read. In the meanwhile, I'll read something more on Natural News. Vitamin D is better than vaccines at preventing flu, the report claims. It's from the Times Online. The risk of children suffering from flu can be halved if they take vitamin D. Doctors in Japan have found the finding has implications for flu epidemics, since vitamin D, which is naturally produced by the human body when exposed to direct sunlight, has no significant side effects, costs little, and can be several times more effective than antiviral drugs or vaccine. Vitamin D was found to protect against influenza A, which caused last year's epidemic, but not against the less common influenza B. The Japanese findings support a theory that low blood levels of the sunshine vitamin occur in winter, explain why flu epidemics generally peak between December and March. Vitamin D activates the innate immune system, enabling the body to produce several proteins such as defensin and capsaicin, which trigger cell activity and disable viruses. I'm not sure I pronounced that right. Dr. Urashima said vitamin D and vaccine work by quite different mechanisms. Vitamin D enhances innate immunity, while vaccine enhances acquired immunity. So we do not have to select only one way of prevention. Rather, we should do both. Dr. John Oxford, professor of virology at Queen Mary School of Medicine in London, said, "This is a timely study. It will be noticed by scientists. It fits in with the seasonal pattern of the flu. There's an increasing background of solid science that makes the vitamin D story credible, but the study needs to be replicated. If it's confirmed, we might think of giving vitamin D at the same time we give vaccine." Why don't we just stick with vitamin D? It has no side effects. And
did you read that?
Vaccine has I don't have it. And has.
It's very funny. Yeah, this one. I'll read it. I just type after.
Iraq, lockdown, beheading, bribes. It's Democratic election time again. And this is by Felicity Arbuthnot from Global Research. The period over which Iraq elections were announced and were campaigned, read, manipulation, threats, arrests, bribes, and even death. could hardly have been chosen with greater crassness, trampling on sensitivities with disregard for remembrance and commemorations, which are the core to Iraqi society. The election was announced on the 12th of February. Campaigning by 6,000 plus would be politicians began the following day, the night of the 13th and 14th, marked the 19th anniversary of the incineration of those in Baghdad's Amriya shelter, one of the bombardment's greatest tragic crimes. The announcement could hardly have had more viciously insensitive timing. You can't push that, you're scratching the thing. The campaign ongoing through the commemoration period of the first Gulf War, 17th of January 1991 to through the 28th of February 1991, with the inestimable loss of Iraqi lives that American generals were frankly not terribly interested in counting. Iraq, in fact, agreed to a ceasefire on the 21st of January 91, brokered and announced by the Soviets. The U.S. brushed it aside 2 full days after the official and agreed end to the hostilities on the 28th of February. The 24th mechanized infantry division slaughtered thousands of Iraqi civilians and retreating troops in the south. Canvassing until polling day on the March 7th was another period of grieving memories, when further thousands then died in an uprising north and south urged by Britain and America, the latter who then aided the bloody quelling of the insurrection. That's us. As with earlier invasions, instigated democratic elections, Iraqis were invited to update their voter registration based on the food ration database, according to the U.S. Embassy facts on the election. As of 2005, meaning that the precious minimal rations can again be used as a weapon, whether by pressure or affiliation, vote the wrong way and the distributor can withhold or withdraw the ration card. Before liberation, the UN opined that the ration system in Iraq was the most efficient, equitable that they had experienced. This in spite of the huge complexities and limitations created by the unique cruelty of the UN's own embargo. For journalist and political observer Steve Lesser, the election date itself has a special cruelty. He writes that the 2003 invasion officially started on that date. When March 7th comes around, I think of all the men, women, and children that have died in Iraq, all the anger directed at the U.S. by the rest of the world, and I think how easily all of this would have been prevented if we had had a president that was honest, interested in the truth. History records that this latest Iraq war began on the 20th of March, 2003, but the events that should have prevented it occurred on the 7th of March, 2003. That was the date, Lesser points out, that the leaders of the weapons inspection, UN MUVIC, delivered their report to the UN, stating that since the arrival in Iraq on the 27th of November 2002, they had visited approximately 350 sites and over 550 inspectors. Access was provided promptly, with the inspectors convinced that Iraqis had no prior knowledge of their impending arrival. Hans Blix, wrote Lesser, stated that Iraq had displayed active or proactive cooperation, which allowed the inspection process to make significant progress. After 3 months of intrusive inspections, no evidence or plausible indication of the revival of nuclear weapons program in Iraq had been found. Blix noted that Iraq had been forthcoming in its cooperation and in making available evidence that can contribute to the resolution of the matters of the IAEA concerns. Further significant effort was underway by Iraq to clarify uncertainty regarding chemical and biological weapons. There was further no evidence of any weaponry being moved by truck or underground facilities as claimed by intelligence authorities. Intelligence authorities were, of course, often not a million miles from Ahmed Chalabi, convicted embezzler, founder of the CIA-backed and funded with eye-watering amounts of U.S. taxpayer dollars, Iraq National Congress, shamefully launched in the British Parliament. Chalabi was also a friend from student days of such arch hawks as Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, and other infamous warmongers. That the rubbish he peddled was believed by the IAEA inspectors surely beggared belief. Molly Ivins has a view on this intelligence black hole, pointing out that what he provided to the Bush administration before the invasion was consistently proved wrong and fraudulent. Her theory is that there is a terrible naivete about neocons that often deludes them believing that they want to be true, believing what they want to be true. They fell for Chalabi for one reason. He said he would reinstate the Iraq-Israel pipeline, recognize Israel, and trade with Israel. Announcement of the pipeline was made within weeks of the invasion. However, since the resistance developed blowing up Iraq's oil infrastructure into an art form to prevent others from getting their hands on Iraq's financial lifeblood, it has, so far as is known, come to nothing. So as Iraqis risk their lives by voting on the day lesser holds that the invasion became carved in stone, Chalabi, convicted con man, honorary neocon, who shared none of Iraqis' tribulations of war, sanctions, result in the Holocaust, Holocaustal death toll, a man who swore allegiance to other countries and holds their passports, heads the de-bathification committee. Bath is, of course, an aspiration of pan-Arab nationalism. If pan-Europeanism is acceptable in the form of the European Union, why not the same should the majority wish for the Middle East? That aside, under the government of Saddam Hussein, it was virtually mandatory to sign up for Bathism to hold employment. The Armani-suited fraudster and foreign passport holder now decides who can run as a candidate, even vote, with his newest, even best friend, Al-Fazai Al-Lami, a person risen without a trace. Anyway, back to the democracy imposed in Iraq. The elections reportedly have had bribes offered on scale as seldom seen anywhere. Prime Minister Nouri Kamal al-Maki gave out pistols emblazoned with a personal stamp. On television, he reportedly defended his actions, saying, "Some people criticize me. I wish I could give a pistol and a rifle to each one who stood beside me in the government." Given the Ministry of Interior militia, reportedly under Malachi's direct control, the cynic might think just a scenario might be possible. In Babel province, further reported the Times, local candidates imported sports equipment, running shoes, traveled for hours to give toys to children, phone cards to adults, and blankets to the poor. Bab Quaba, frozen chickens were distributed. With such a rush on this free bounty, the stocks were quickly exhausted. Stocks of heating oil and rice were lavishly donated. Writing in the National, Nazir Latif writes detail of people selling their votes to the highest bidder. A whole cottage industry flourished around the country with media men and women handing out money for votes to pass on to the election agents. One such vote trader remarked that none of them cares who wins, none of them thinks it will make any difference, so they give me their vote and I sell it. Iraqis seem to be grasping the principle of U.S.-UK-style democracy pretty rapidly. The democracy has so far, after just over a week, descended into allegations of fraud, questions about alleged extra 7 million ballot papers, surplus to the requirements, and a wrangling between Ahmed Chalabi's cousin, former puppet Prime Minister Ayed Alawi, and current puppet Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki for supremacy. The former as his cousin, the CIA man, and latter closer to Iran. Alawi was also alleged to have shot 6 handcuffed insurgents at point-blank range 3 weeks before he became Prime Minister in 2004. His ties to the CIA and statements from ex-long-term CIA operatives go back to 1992. Patrick Cockburn details links to 15 different intelligence agencies. Sounds pretty much like the last great leap from the new Iraq, the farce of Viceroys J. Garner, Paul Brunner, wrangling chaos in the subsequent 2005 elections. For those who believe in omens, one should keep both Malachi and Alawi awake at nights in a vast rally just prior to voting day. Noriel Maliki's Interior Minister Jawad al-Baloni released flocks of doves to signify reconciliation and harmony. Simultaneously, a massive fireworks display began, barbecuing many of the soaring doves. That's about right.
So, anyway, yeah, I mean, what a waste, huh? What a waste. Waste. Here's something that came up. Cheney pleads guilty to war crimes. This is from globalresearch.ca and the Washington blog. This came out in February, obviously nobody acted upon it, huh?
He doesn't really
plead
guilty. He says things that would make you think that he committed war crimes that fit the pattern.
Right.
That he, you know, the way the article is titled, it's very misleading.
But I'll just quote something that Cheney said so that you realize that what happened is Cheney pronounced himself a big supporter of waterboarding, a near-drowning technique that has been regarded as torture back to the Spanish Inquisition and has long been treated by the U.S. authorities as a serious war crime, such as when Japanese commanders were prosecuted for using it on American prisoners during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Cheney answered with an emphatic yes when asked if he had opposed the Bush administration's decision to suspend the use of waterboarding after it was employed against three high-value detainees, sometimes in repetitive sequences. Yeah, that waterboarding should still be on the table today. Speaking with a sense of impunity, he casually negated a key line of defense that senior Bush officials had hidden behind for years, that the brutal interrogations were approved by independent Justice Department legal experts, who thus gave the administration a legitimate reason to believe the actions were within the law. However, on Sunday, this was February, Cheney acknowledged that the White House had told the Justice Department lawyers for legal opinions to render, in other words, the opinions amounted to ordered up lawyering to permit the administration to do whatever it wanted. This is not entirely surprising because in 2005, Cheney pressured the U.S. Department of Justice to approve torture. So he has admitted it. I mean, it's against the Geneva Conventions. It's considered war crime. But yet here the guy is walking around like people are still listening to this piece of crap. All right? It's unbelievable. It's just totally unbelievable, you know, that this man can get away with what he's gotten away with. Here's another piece of work. If anybody's a Catholic out there, I suggest you tune out because your Pope is a pimp. All right? The Pope knew the priest was pedophile, but allowed him to continue with his ministry. This is on Times Online. The Pope was drawn directly into the Roman Catholic sex abuse scandal last night. Now, this was March 13th, this was written. Last night, as news emerged of his part in a decision to send a pedophile priest for therapy, the clerk went on to reoffend and was convicted of child... was convicted of child abuse, but continues to work as a priest in Upper Bavaria. The priest was sent from Essen to Munich for therapy in 1980 when he was accused of forcing an 11-year-old boy to perform oral sex. Mm-hmm. The archdiocese confirmed that the Pope, who was then a cardinal, had approved a decision to accommodate the priest in a rectory while the therapy took place. The priest, identified only as H, was subsequently convicted of sexually abusing minors after he was moved to pastoral work in nearby Graffing. In 1986, he was given an 18-month suspended jail sentence and fined £4,000, where there have been no formal charges against him since. And the church has been accused of a cover-up after at least 170 allegations of child abuse by German Catholic priests. Yeah, I wouldn't doubt if this guy was a if this Pope rat was wasn't a pedophile. You know what I mean? Amazing how they can put how you can put it off. I mean,
the archbishops did the same thing in this country.
Archbishops and the bishops. This guy's a cardinal. Now he's a pope. You know, I mean, anybody who wears
he did that when he was a bishop or archbishop.
Archbishop, yeah. No, he was a cardinal. And I mean, anybody who can wear little red shoes, he's got to be a little strange. You know what I mean? Anyway, the Archdiocese of Munich and Freising said that there had been no complaints against the priest during the therapy at a church community. The Vatican said the manager, Gruber, had taken full responsibility for the priest's move back into pastoral work. Yeah. Well, anyway, the Pope and all of his little pedophilic SOB cardinals, priests, archbishops, altar boys, everybody. I mean, it's a sick, sick religion, folks. It's a sick, sick bunch of people running this thing. I swear to God, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. This guy calls himself the Christ, all right? He's the Christ, all right? And a representative of Christ.
Vicar of Christ.
Vicar of Christ, yeah. Anyway, Beyond Orwell. You want to read that one, or you want me to?
Go ahead. I read three.
Yeah. A true, this is from, I don't know where this is from. Oh, this is Global Research, too. Let's see. Beyond Orwell, the Electronic Police State, 2010. A truism, perhaps, but before resorting to brute force and open repression to halt the barbarians at the gates, that would be us, the masters of declining empires and the chattering classes who polish their boots, regale us with tales of democracy on the march, hope, and other banalities before the mailed fist comes crashing down. Putting it another way, as the late great situationist, the malcontent Guy Debord did decades ago in his relentless call for revolt, the society of the spectacle. The reigning economic system is a vicious circle of isolation. Its technologies are based on isolation, and they contribute to that same isolation. From automobiles to television, the goods that the spectacular system chooses to produce also serve it as weapons for constantly reinforcing the conditions that engender lonely crowds. With ever-increasing concreteness, the spectacle recreates its own presumptions. And when those presumptions reproduce ever more wretched clichés promulgated by true believers or rank optimists, take your pick, market democracy, the freedom to choose, the length of one's chains, or even quaint notions of national sovereignty, we're left with a fraud, a gigantic swindle, and a postmodern refinement of tried and true methods that would do Orwell proud. Ponder DeBoard's rigorous theorem and substitute cell phones and GPS for automobile and internet for television, and you're soon left with the nauseating sense that the old infoban isn't all it's cracked up to be, as a seamless means for effecting control, on the other hand, of our thoughts, our actions, even our whereabouts. Well, that's another story entirely. In this light, a new report published by Crypto Hippie, the Electronics Police State, 2010 National Ranking, delivers the goods and rips away the veil from the smirking visage of corporate crooks and media apologists of America's burgeoning police state. When we produced our first electronic state police state report, Crypto Hippie's analysis writes, the top 10 nations were of two types: those that had the will to spy on every citizen but lacked ability; those who had the ability but were restrained in will. But as they reveal in new national rankings, this is changing. The ability, the able have become willing, and their traditional restraints have failed. The key developments driving the global panopticon forward are the following. The USA has negated their constitutional Fourth Amendment in the name of protection and in the names of war against terror, drugs, and cyber attacks. The UK is aggressively building the world of 1984 in the name of stopping antisocial activities. Their populace seem unable or unwilling to restrain the government. And France and the EU have given themselves over to central bureaucratic control. And in France, the German news magazine Spiegel reported that a new law passed by the lower house of parliament in February conjures up the specter of Big Brother and the surveillance state, and similar to legislation signed into law by German President Horst Kohler last month, police and security forces in France would be granted authority to surreptitiously install malware known as a Trojan horse to spy on private computers. Remote access to a user's personal data would be made possible under a judge supervision. Well, French parliamentarians aligned with right-wing President Nicolas Sarkozy, insisting the measure is intended to filter and block websites and criminal content or to halt allegedly illegal file sharing, civil libertarians have denounced the legislation. And the article goes on for another page or two, but I suggest it is a good article, and it talks a great deal about what's happening around the world, in the United States and everywhere, as far as Big Brother coming down and taking over. And it's you can check it out, Beyond Orwell, Electronic State 2010. That's on globalresearch.ca. And what time is it? It's 8:30. So I'm going to see. We got our interview with Dahlia Wasi is coming up, and she is, like Lila mentioned earlier, she's a human rights watcher and advocate for not only for the Palestinian people, but people around the world, and specifically in Iraq. And tonight she'll be talking a great deal about Rachel Corrie. And the Palestinian problem.
And what happened on her two visits to Iraq.
Right, and because it is the, yesterday was the seventh anniversary of her death. So let's see if this works, and we will be back after this interview.
Take a minute to cue it.
States to an American Jewish mother and an Iraqi Muslim father. She lived in Iraq as a child, returning to the U.S. at age 5. After graduating from Swarthmore College with a B.A. in biology in 1993, she earned her medical degree from the University of Pennsylvania in 1997. Dr. Wasfi has made 2 trips to Iraq to visit her extended family since 2003 shock and awe invasion, including a 3-month stay in Basra in the spring of 2006. She has brought her eyewitness account of life under the occupation to over 200 audiences in 22 states in the U.S., the Capitol Hill in D.C., Ontario in British Columbia, Madrid, Spain in 2007, and the 3rd International Iraqi Conference in Berlin, Germany in March of 2008. Based on her experiences, Dr. Wasfi is speaking out in support of immediate, unconditional withdrawal of American forces from Iraq and Afghanistan and the need to end the occupation from the Nile to the Euphrates. She is currently working on a book. Her website is www.liberatethis.com. And Leo is trying to get a hold of her. In the meantime, while he's doing that, I also wanted to mention, I didn't have time to say this, but in October of 2009, there was a legal case filed at the Audiencia Nacional in Spain against 4 U.S. presidents and 4 U.K. prime ministers for commissioning, condoning, and or perpetrating multiple war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide in Iraq. The case was filed under the laws of universal jurisdiction. This case, naming George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, William J. Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, Margaret Thatcher, John Major, Anthony Blair, and Gordon Brown, was brought by Iraqis and others who stand in solidarity with the Iraqi people in defense of their rights and international law. And here's what it was based on. A 13-year sanctions regime on Iraq known and proven to have an overwhelming destructive impact on Iraqi public health, especially child mortality. The use of disproportionate and indiscriminate military force, including numerous extralegal strikes and bombing campaigns throughout the 90s, entailing the purposeful destruction of Iraq's water and health facilities and defense capacities. Leo's going to get that phone. And the widespread contamination of Iraq's water and life environment by unjustified and massive use of depleted uranium munitions. Number three, the prevention by means of comprehensive sanctions and or military strikes of the reconstruction of Iraq's critical civil infrastructure, including its health, water, and sanitation system, and the decontamination of Iraq's ecosphere, life environment, backed by the threat of the Security Council veto, where unanimity was not present for such strikes, and the continuance of sanction regimes. And the decontamination has to do with that depleted uranium. The launching of an illegal war of aggression against Iraq based on deliberate falsification of threat assessment intelligence and systematic efforts to conceal from the general public in the United States and the United Kingdom. And five, establishing by design an occupation apparatus that by its incompetence, inexperience, corruption, and or ideological or sectarian alignment and actions would finalize the destruction of the Iraqi state. And so that's the lawsuit that's filed against those presidents and prime ministers. And we can go back into that a little bit more later on in the show.
That was a great article. But now we have Dahlia's on the line. Hello, Dahlia. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, this is Lila speaking, and we're very pleased to have you on the show, Dahlia.
My pleasure.
I guess tonight you were going to talk a little bit about the anniversary of the death of Rachel Corrie and what happened to her. Do you want to refresh our listeners about what happened to her?
Certainly. In March of 2003, Rachel Corrie was a 23-year-old college student at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. And following the events of September 11, 2001, Rachel wanted to explore the Arab world and the Muslim world in particular, trying to identify what might have been an explanation for what happened in the United States in 2001. And her efforts brought her to join the ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, which is a nonviolent movement. They train individuals in civil disobedience and nonviolence to protest, demonstrate against the illegal actions of the occupation forces in Palestine and to defend international law. And Rachel went to Gaza as a volunteer with the ISM. And on March 16th, 2003, she and I think five of her colleagues were trying to prevent the demolition of the home of a Palestinian pharmacist, his family, and his brother and his family. Rachel had spent several nights at the home of this pharmacist, so the kids inside the house were like family to her. And on that day, there was about a 3.5-hour standoff with one bulldozer. Rachel succeeded in deterring that first bulldozer, but a second one came. And to the shock of everyone present, that bulldozer mowed Rachel down, kept the blade down, and backed up over her. And when her friends got to her, she said, "I think my back is broken." And those were her last words. She died soon thereafter. The Israeli soldiers were driving an American-made Caterpillar D9 bulldozer in violation of international law. The destruction of homes is in violation of international law. This is occupied land. Rachel was murdered that day. Her story is very important to me because when I heard about her, I've never met her, I never did meet her, but when I heard about her, I was going through a crisis in my life about who I was and what was my purpose in life. And when I saw that she had gone thousands of miles to literally stand up for people whom her only connection to them was her humanity, and she ended up giving her life that day, then I thought, well, I should probably go see my family in Iraq, whom I haven't seen for 27 years. So it was 7 years ago today that Rachel was killed. And her parents, Craig and Cindy Corey, are currently in Haifa in Israel. They're amidst the civil case that has taken 7 years to come to trial. And hopefully some tiny bit of justice will be served in the outcome of that case.
So there was actually no criminal case.
There was an investigation, whatever quality investigation done by the occupation forces, and they ruled it was an accident.
I wanted to ask you. I know you give up your clinical practice as a doctor to do this, and what that must have been quite a catharsis, actually, for you to do that, or quite a decision.
Yeah, I wish it had been a smooth transition, but unfortunately, I had taken this track to train in medicine, gone straight through college medical school. I was in my fifth year of residency. It was 5 years because I switched specialties, and it would have been my final year. At the same time, September 11th, 2001 came and went, and I began to experience a lot of racism from my colleagues, who actually, they spoke freely because they didn't realize that my background was Arab. And I started to have a real crisis of conscience because I was thinking about the work that I was doing, some of which was delivering anesthesia so people could have elective plastic surgery done. Meanwhile, people were dying in Afghanistan, thanks to my tax dollars, that my government was building up to invading Iraq. And it was like reliving the Gulf War all over again, which was certainly not the trauma that people on the ground experienced, but it was traumatic in my own world back in 1991. And I had to take leave from my residency. It became a crisis in my life, and it was during this time off that I was trying to find a way forward, and then I heard about Rachel's story, and then I thought, well, maybe while I'm still here on this earth, Rachel's gone, but I can go see my family, and if I can move forward from there, I can try to share Rachel's story as one of my inspirations.
And how did you find your family when you got there? What condition were they in?
Well, it was when I got, I had distant relatives in Baghdad, but my dad is originally from Basra in southern Iraq. Mm. So that first trip in 2004, I flew to Jordan, took the 10-hour car ride to Baghdad, and then after a couple of days, one of my cousins drove 6 hours up from Basra to pick me up, and then we drove back down together. I expected it because I had the knowledge of what had happened to Iraq through the Iran-Iraq War, through the Gulf War, and the period of economic sanctions that was a huge obstacle to reconstruction. But to see firsthand the destruction that our missiles can do was really a shock, and I was very ashamed, and I expected to be resented as an American. And probably, maybe I would have been if it had been a stranger I was meeting, but my family welcomed me as if they had known me their entire lives and showered affection on me and stuffed me with food, which is the traditional Arab hospitality. But it was really a wake-up for me because yes, I was miserable with what was happening in my life, but I had taken for granted the basic things of electricity and water and security. And these were things that Iraqis had before the invasion, and we took that from them.
Mm-hmm.
So I became inspired then to try to share their story once I got back home to the U.S. as someone who was born in New York. I'm an American by birth, someone who doesn't have a foreign accent, and try to make people understand that there are families on the other end of our weapons, and to try to take that into account with our foreign policy.
I found that you've made many statements and before Congress and of course in the speeches, but the conditions in Iraq, just recently, I think within the last 3 or 4 months, I remember reading a current article about all of Baghdad had no water, nothing. All the electricity and water, they were out of it, and the sewers weren't working, and everything else like this. And that was recent. That was this year. Have you heard? I mean, the media, the mainstream media, says nothing about this. I mean, I read this from an internet source, but have you heard any from anybody over there now, and what the conditions are like now? Have they got any kind of services?
Well, I also get a lot of my information from alternative sources,
right,
on the internet. It varies. According to my family, when the extremes of temperature come, the hot, hot days of summer and the cold, cold nights of winter, the electricity becomes more scarce. And I believe the reason for that is corruption, because whoever is doling out the electricity, if you pay them enough money, they will give your neighborhood more hours of the day with electricity.
Okay.
But what happens is the reason the water is tied to the electricity, because Iraq is in the desert, of course, and they use electric pumps to bring water into the homes from a reservoir. We have massive, I noticed it when I came back to the States, these massive water towers that are our reservoirs for our neighborhoods and cities. But they don't have that in Iraq, and the reason they don't is that the progression of Iraqi society was mostly halted during the 1980s because of the Iran-Iraq War. And then during the 1990s, the infrastructure had been smashed, and economic sanctions blocked the materials to come in to rebuild. So the sewage in the streets is from back in 91. And those limits on electricity, water, and security continue to this day. What most people rely on, which adds to the air pollution and the noise pollution, are generators. And this was now more sophisticated generators have come in, but pretty much in the beginning, and as far as I know, unless they set up their own grid for the green zone, that green zone operates and the military camps operate on generators. And that, of course, requires fuel, often diesel fuel.
What's the economy there? I mean, what are the jobs? I mean, I heard it was 50% unemployment there. Is that correct?
Well, exactly. We said we were bringing them America. We said we were bringing the democracy and freedom of America, but we brought the lack of jobs, the lack of health care, and the lack of education. Depending on where you are in the country, that's the number I have as well, 50 to 70% unemployment, and those higher numbers in those cities that have been really devastated by American occupation, like in Ramadi and Fallujah. The reason for the lack of jobs is much like the reason for the lack of jobs here. In the United States, corporations have been outsourcing jobs overseas so that they can pay lower wages and have wider profit margins. Same thing in Iraq, except that they basically import workers. A lot of them come from Southeast Asia, and if they get paid wages, they are slave wages. And what had been reported was that the corporations, the companies that brought these workers in, were confiscating their passports, so they become trapped. And and then essentially they do become slaves in the American system.
Now, I heard that. I read recently, and we've read it on this show, about the billions and billions of dollars in cash that have been funneled into Iraq, okay, by the United States, and paid to pay off everybody. I mean, it's a completely corrupt system. I read a report where some soldiers are actually kicking bundles of $100 bills, playing football with them. That's how much cash there was. All right? And of course, all of that cash was being stolen, was being thrown away with this and that. But it sounds like none of that money has helped anybody but a few corrupt pockets.
Yeah, I think Dick Cheney's doing all right these days, but you're right. Under the rule of Administrator Paul Bremer, $9 billion went missing. There were also billions of dollars that were Iraqi assets, which were frozen after Iraqi troops moved into Kuwait in 1990. Halliburton took that money. This is basically your textbook case of rape and pillage by the occupation forces as part of colonialism. And that's, you know, some people will say, well, that's an antiquated term. Well, that's what we're seeing today. This is basically the expansion of the American empire to take the resources of Western Asia at the expense of the indigenous peoples, plain and simple.
Now, they also they also looted the Iraqi museum.
Well, this is the real, this is part of the denigration of a culture, and the humiliation is to control a people, you take away their history.
Right.
Now, with Iraq, you're taking away, that's the history of human civilization.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just Iraqis who were hurt. It was, you know, our global existence. And certainly there was a lot of money to be made with those pieces, and they went with such swiftness and such efficiency that there was suspicion of organized looting. And I just ordered my book called Cultural Cleansing in Iraq, which I need to go through to see what evidence they have of an orchestrated liquidation of the National Museum artifacts.
As bad as everything that you've just talked about is, the thing that concerns me the most is the fact that the country has been poisoned by depleted uranium and other chemicals.
Thank you for mentioning that. There's so many aspects of this tragedy, and depleted uranium is a poison that we've used. We used it for the first time in Iraq in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
U.S. and NATO forces used it in the bombing of Kosovo in 1999. We used it in Afghanistan from 2001 through today.
Yep.
And we've been using it intermittently in Iraq during the 1990s after bombings of the southern no-fly zone after the first Gulf War. And then, of course, in the major bombardments in 2002, 2003, through the present. And one of the most horrific and notable evidence pools is now in Fallujah, and that's getting some international coverage of the number of birth defects that are occurring in Fallujah and new epidemiology of diseases that have never been seen before. And this just happens to be following the major sieges of 2004, and it takes several years for the effects of the radiation to take place, and I believe that's what is being manifested today. There cannot be a direct link established with depleted uranium until studies are done, and no effective studies can be done until there is security, until the occupation ends, and until people can get in there. But, of course, the people who stand the most to lose by such studies are the same ones who would fund them. And so it's a tremendous tragedy for this generation, for the next generation, and possibly, you know, for generations, for years to come, because we've now dropped in Iraq alone an estimated over 2,000 tons, which is microscopic, aerosolized, radioactive dust and this is a war crime, and this is in my book, it's an act of genocide.
Oh, absolutely, I agree with you
100%.
And just let me finish. The irony of that is that that not only affects the Iraqi people, that goes into the air, it's blown around the world, and also the exposure of the American troops. They suffered the same exposure as the Iraqi people. And they are also bringing home those cancers and those effects.
Exactly, exactly. This is the most likely, depleted uranium is the most likely etiology of Gulf War syndrome.
Yeah.
While there were under 300 fatalities of American military personnel during the first Gulf War, there are now over 12,500 dead from 1991. And if you think of who the military population is mostly, it's young, healthy men.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is killing them off to this degree? The investigations have to be done, and for their children, because there were significant increases in birth defects and deformities in the children of Desert Storm veterans. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, we can be a little short-sighted. Our policymakers can be short-sighted, thinking that we're dumping our radioactive waste on the other side of the planet, but it's going to blow back here, and the innocent are paying the price.
Yeah, it's right now. I read recently that it's got Iraq has the highest birth defect rate in the world.
I can't imagine what the rate of cancer rate is.
Must
be astronomical.
Yeah, and it's unbelievable. But with your medical background, and we have medical background, are you working in any capacity in those countries, or with doctors or other organizations to provide any medical assistance to some of these people? Or,
you know, I get asked that question a lot, and my standard response is I couldn't handle the stress in Georgetown University Hospital, which is very, you know, in the wealthy elite Georgetown neighborhood of Washington D.C. to start dropping bombs around me, and I'm going to be a patient rather than any sort of help as a doctor.
Those individuals who
can work with the organizations and provide medical aid in the midst of a war zone, those are really tremendous individuals with an unbelievable amount of courage and fortitude, and my hats off to them.
How can we, right now, I know you have you're working on a book, but you also have a good website, and it's liberatethis.com. And can you tell our listeners, is there any organization or any other place that they can get specific, good, reliable, specific information on the atrocities in Iraq? Because you're not getting it from mainstream at all. Right.
And, you know, you would hope that with the mantra of support the troops, that there would at least be decent coverage for the soldiers. But it's all about public relations for
mm-hmm.
American foreign policy. So it's difficult information to find. Yes, my favorite source of information is my website, liberatethis.com. Thank you for the plug.
Okay.
And I have a section on my website called Further Reading, and there are dozens of articles there that span from, I guess, 2006 when I started collecting them through today. On a number of different topics, including why we invaded Iraq, the nature of occupation, war crimes, women, depleted uranium. So numerous topics arranged alphabetically. I get a lot of my information from alternative resources, Truthout, Truthdig, and oftentimes, you know, I'm lucky my mom will send me stuff. It's a search for references. And another good place to check in terms of reliability of sources is a site called sourcewatch.org. And they usually have the nitty-gritty about where, basically following the money. Because when you follow the money, you can find out people's motivations, and that will help you discern fact from fiction.
Do you get updates from your relatives over there at our...
I speak to them. I try to get to them about once a week, and I just at this point I just ask how they are. There's been it's been a really difficult few months in my family. My dad lost his closest brother, and one of my cousins was in a very bad car accident and needs an operation that can't be done in Iraq. So their suffering is that, you know, I try to make them laugh on the phone, because if I can hear them laugh, it makes me feel better. But they have, my cousins who were born in the 1980s have known nothing but war and occupation their whole lives. Mm. And I just wish I could get back to see them. The more distant relatives who were living in Baghdad, they are virtually, except for maybe one or two, they're all refugees now. And they were fortunate that they had the financial means to leave Iraq, and they're in Jordan and Syria now. So it's devastating. And believe me, this is my story of my family, but this is the Iraqi story now. It's a displacement and loss and suffering and struggle. And all I want, first and foremost, is for the occupation to end, because that is the key to the beginning of healing.
I thought that from a recent cuts, you would be more up on this than I. But recent counts are anywhere from 850 to a million Iraqis have died, and upwards of over three million refugees. Can you validate that, or have you had any other updates on those statistics?
Yeah, it's difficult, and I would say that for those numbers, it's at least that much. The last official report that I'm familiar with came out in 2007, and that was by the British firm called ORB, which is, I think, Opinion Research Business. And it's linked from my site under Casualties Iraqi. And that was an estimate of a million Iraqis
killed. Okay.
Mm-hmm. There's a group called Just Foreign Policy. Their site is justforeignpolicy.org. And what they do is they extrapolate from the results of the 2006 Lancet study, the Hopkins study that was done in coordination with
that was 650,000, I remember.
That's right, 655,000 in 2006.
Right. Yeah, I remember we read that here.
Today,
yeah.
Which is now estimating to almost 1.4 million. We're never going to know, especially in the rural areas where our bombs have fallen, and with the Muslim tradition of burial within 24 hours. We will never. In addition to that, we have. Our soldiers have buried many, many people in mass graves, so it's only ballpark. The estimate for refugees, if you count from the 1990s, it's as high as 6 million, but somewhere over 5 million is a good estimate as I know it. Now you're talking about that's 25% of the population that's either dead or displaced. So it's a horrific impact, and this is our legacy.
And how are we justifying that? I mean, how in God's name are we justifying that kind of genocide, without saying genocide,
Well,
Americans are great at this. I mean, we're great at genocide.
Well, our government trumped up a reason to go in there on falsified information, and that's what the mainstream media sticks to.
Absolutely. And this is, and there's a reason why we don't see the suffering. We don't see the suffering of the returning veterans at Walter Reed Hospital.
We don't
get coverage of the epidemic suicide rate among soldiers and Marines. It's barely a blip in America's consciousness of what happened at Fort Hood back in November,
right.
Which reflected the trauma that is being experienced by soldiers and by their mental health providers.
Now, there's something
and
really
that just
strange.
Dropped out of the news
that went out
as
of the, yeah.
they came in.
And that gunman actually lived. As far as we know, he's still alive.
Absolutely, and I haven't heard a thing since 2010 began.
Right.
So it's definitely, and it's all public relations. You know, we were upset during the Bush administration that the officials would not allow pictures of the dead coming home. They said it was out of respect for the families, but even families begging to take pictures were denied.
Right.
And when Obama came in, he said, okay, you can take pictures. We're still not seeing them.
That's right.
The press.
That's right. They're not putting them out.
We don't see them in the corporate media because the corporate media is tied to corporations who are making money
mm-hmm.
off of the occupation, and that's the bottom line.
Well, I mean,
well, this
I
is American foreign policy is being initiated and carrying out for the sake of corporations.
Sake of war. But I read recently on the show, it was a few months back, they came out with the most censored news mediums, the countries that had the most censored news media in the world, okay, out of 100 countries, I believe. Then the United States was the 24th, all right. It was number 24,
most
all right,
censored.
Most censored country in the world, okay, and 25 was Saudi Arabia.
That's
a dictatorship.
In terms of how we characterize ourselves versus
yeah.
other nations.
Mm-hmm.
We see the effects of it. Unfortunately, we will see other effects of our disrespect for human life down the road. I mean, if what goes around comes around, we are in deep, deep trouble because of what our government has done in our name.
Well, not only our government, but what our media is doing, what our news media is doing, what our everything. I mean, everything is tied in with this. The corporate media, the corporate advertising, corporate media, the government. In fact, we found out. I was reading recently that it's been known for a while, but again, it came up that most of the bills in Congress are written by lobbyists. Most of the news that is out there is promoted by pharmaceutical companies, corporations. All of the news that we see on network news, all right, is either through is written by or for the pharmaceutical companies to benefit the car companies, to benefit the military. Okay, and to put a clamp in, and of course censor all sensitive military information. All right.
That's the beauty and why I'm so happy to be on your show and I appreciate your efforts because it's hard to how do you overcome the military industrial complex and all the arms that reach out from it.
Right.
We don't as individuals it's hard to imagine that, but we can take the steps that we can take, and so I have information to share. But if I'm sitting at home by myself, my dog is sick of hearing it. So I appreciate having another audience, and I really appreciate the efforts you're making to get out the ground truth.
Well, we really appreciate having you on the show to talk about your experience and your very personal experience in this deep, deep tragedy. And there's really no words to convey. How you feel about something like this, and to know that it's the country that we live in that's perpetrated this, it makes you feel sort of sick. And I hope that somewhere, somehow, that people can really affect change with our foreign policy because it's wrong.
And one more question I have, and we're running out of time, but I just got to do a quick ID. This is WQQQ 103.3 FM in Sharon Lake, Fluin, Milton. You're listening to the LA Still Show, and we're now talking with Dr. Dalia Wasfi. And one more question I have for you before we go, and that is, are you still finding a lot of prejudice, a lot of anger vented towards you
personally
as a not just a spokeswoman, but as a Muslim? I don't know. You know, I don't know if you're a Muslim, but
correct.
But as a Middle East descent.
Well, you know, it's funny because my father is Muslim, and by Muslim law, you are what your father is.
Oh.
And my mom is Jewish, and by Judaic law, you are what your mother is.
Right.
So I'm just extremely confused. Having been said, you know, I've always felt I've sort of grown up. I grew up in Dover, Delaware, which because of the Air Force base is a military town. It's a very black and white town. So I always felt like an other, an outsider.
Right.
And so I don't really notice it too much anymore, and I'm not a kid anymore, so I can hold my own better these days. But it can show its face in contexts where people just don't realize. I mean, I'm on networking sites like Facebook, and sometimes you can find quite a bit of stuff there. Occasionally, through the anonymity that the internet offers, I will get nasty comments. But in all honesty, if that's all I have to face compared to what the people in Iraq and Afghanistan deal with, that's a small price to pay. And I, you know, I gain a great deal. I'm really the one who benefits the most from the work I do. I get to vent, I get to pass on information, and I get to share my story. So that brings me a great deal of relief and fulfillment.
Well, we appreciate you being on, and maybe we can have you back on again in the near future. But
my pleasure. Thank you both so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure talking to you, Dalia.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye. That was Dalia Wasfi.
Yeah.
Talking about her experience.
And you can go to her website, which is
www.liberatethis.com.
Liberatethis.com.
And
all right, we're going to bring up Woody in just a second here. Hey. Okay, so that was last night's interview with Dalia Wasfi, and I hope you enjoyed that. And tomorrow night we will venture into the world of spirits. And Friday night, I believe we'll have George Dixon joining us. So look forward to talking to you tomorrow. Please join us, and I hope you enjoy this show. And if you're listening to this in the archives, please share it with people who may be interested in what's going on. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Good night.